House Committee on Energy and the Environment, Friday, March 9th, 2007, 1 p.m. in the Benn City Council Chambers. Chair, Representative Jackie Dingfelter.
And we are going to open up the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you. I want to, first of all, thank the City of Benn for hosting us here today, and I want to thank my Vice Chair, Representative Chuck Burley, for organizing and making sure that we were coordinated with our, we had a field trip this morning to several very interesting companies here in Benn, and I wanted to thank my Vice Chair for helping set that up and also for coordinating, the staff, Jesse, for coordinating with the city and letting us use these facilities. I am State Representative Jackie Dingfelter. I'm Chair of the House Energy and Environment Committee, and I'm going to ask all the committee members to introduce themselves, since there's a lot of new faces out in the audience today, so you have a sense of who we are and what districts we represent. I actually am serving my fourth term in the Oregon Legislature, and I represent a district in Northeast Portland. I spend a lot of time in Central Oregon recreating and supporting the economy here, so I will tell you that it's one of my favorite places to be, and the only thing I'm kicking myself right now is that I didn't bring my backcountry skis with me, but I'm sure I'll be back if you guys have a good snowpack this year. But again, it's really a pleasure to be here, and I think I'll start way down at the end here with our senator and have him introduce. I don't think he needs introduction, but I wanted to welcome our senator and really pleased that you were able to join us today.
Senator Ben Westland, representing the greatest Senate district in Oregon.
I'm State Representative Terry Beyer, and I represent Springfield. This is my third term, and along with this lovely committee, which I'm enjoying, I chair transportation.
Can we say Cooley Road?
I've heard that word. She's being educated in this. Our committee staff, Pat McGinnis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. State Representative Chuck Burley, and I represent the greatest House district.
Exactly.
And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, very much, and committee members for taking the time today, but I think we would all appreciate the fact it was good to get out of the Capitol after the recent days and tough negotiations we went through to finally pass a rainy day fund out of the State House.
Yay.
I also want to thank the city staff and everybody else that helped put this together and the folks that are here today testifying on what I think is a very, very important issue and something that we're all very dedicated to making happen for the state of Oregon.
I'm Representative Ben Cannon from the 46th House District, which is adjacent to Representative Dingfelter's in parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. And this is my very first term in the Oregon Legislature, and it is exciting to be on my very first committee field trip. So thank you to the folks of Ben for welcoming us here today.
Representative Cannon got to see his first fish screen today from the Central Oregon Irrigation District, so that was very exciting. But it is, I think, fitting that we are here for an informational meeting on, or informational hearing on renewable energy, that we're here in Central Oregon. Today we visited the facility at Idatech and PV Power, so we got a sense of some of the growing industries that are right here in Central Oregon. And so with that, I'm going to open up an informational meeting on renewable energy. And the reason that this is informational and we're not having a hearing on Senate Bill 373, which is probably some of you familiar if you've read in the paper the past few days, is that's a Senate bill with a renewable energy standard. And that is a bill that's in the Senate right now, and hearings are ongoing. And we were hoping that there was a possibility that we might have had the bill over in the House, but that hasn't happened yet. The hearings have just started, and I have been able to sit in on some of those hearings. But today, this will actually lay the groundwork for the hearings that we will hear in this committee, because we're going to hear a little bit about the different types of renewable energy that are homegrown right here in Oregon. And I think that we'll hear about how this renewable energy standard that's being proposed could affect Oregon. So I think this is an excellent opportunity for the committee members to learn about the basics of renewable energy. And really, this is the first time that this committee, we spent many, many, many hours hearing testimony on biofuels and renewable fuel, and that is passed out of the House, but we haven't yet delved into the renewable energy realm. And I apologize because I wanted to welcome the city manager and thank him for making this possible as well.
Thank you very much for coming here. I think it's very appropriate to welcome you and if you can do anything to make your stay more comfortable or provide you with your experience. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. So first we are going to hear from Sylvia Hayes, and she's going to talk about sustainable energy opportunities and challenges in Central Oregon and sort of provide an overview. So we appreciate you coming here today, Sylvia. And for the record, if you can just state your name.
Sure. And chairs and committee members, I really appreciate being here and not having to go to Salem, which we've been doing too much of lately. I'm Sylvia Hayes. I'm executive director of 3E Strategies. And I was asked today to talk, to kind of lay an overview, and I'm going to start real big, but I am going to bring it back to Central Oregon. I happen to believe that passage of a renewable energy standard for Oregon is extremely important, and I think that it's really, really critical that we understand that when it comes to our energy situation, we are absolutely in new territory. This is a chart that just shows the increasing demand and consumption of oil globally. This shows a decade-by-decade discovery rate for oil starting in the 30s. We peaked in the 60s. It's been going down since then. And that red line you're seeing is the graph you just saw. That's the escalating demand overlaid on decreasing oil discoveries. This is straight from ExxonMobil. The green area is existing production of a global oil supply. You can see that it started to fall off in 2004, 2005. That red triangle is the estimated amount of additional oil supply that will be needed to meet that 3% per year increase in demand. What's pretty interesting is that that red triangle is 9 Saudi Arabia's worth of oil. This is a massive scale issue that we're dealing with here. So to put it in perspective, demand is growing rapidly. In the 1970s, when we had our first energy crisis in the U.S., we were importing 34% of our oil. We're currently importing 60%. We will soon be at 70%. U.S. has 2% of the world's oil reserves, period. And then there is the China factor. You probably are aware that less than a year ago, our national debt ceiling was raised, and we now are nearing $9 trillion in national debt. China is the chief funder of our national debt, and China recently became the world's second leading importer of oil, right behind the United States. And then, of course, there is a climate change issue, which is very much associated with the energy issue. And I won't cover much of this, but I just want to point out one thing. This is a chart that shows the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere going back 450,000 years. The important thing to note here is that you'll see historically those levels are somewhere between 200 and 300 parts per million. It's not a real big fluctuation. But the difference between the valley at 200 parts per million and the peak at 300 is the difference historically between an ice age and an interglacial period. You get all the way over to the right, you'll see where we are today. We're close to 400 parts per million. And if we continue on business as usual, by 2050, we will be nearing 700 parts per million atmospheric CO2 concentration. It's a level we know for sure the planet hasn't seen for the last 650,000 years. And despite your noticing our good snowpack this year, and Oregon's had a couple of good snow years, historically our snowpack is definitely decreasing. There's clear evidence of that. I mean, we're now looking at the park formerly known as Glacier. It really is a significant issue, and I tell you, you can talk to the farmers in the Klamath area and the fishers on the southern Oregon coast who have recently had their fishery declared a national disaster, and they will tell you they know they're facing the impacts of increasing water issues because of climate change. All of these really are important considerations when you'll be considering Senate Bill 373 when it makes it your way. So bringing it down to Oregon specifically then, here's how Oregon uses energy. Not quite 50% of it is petroleum, 19% natural gas, 22% electricity. That little 12% pie that says renewable resources, that at this level is including things like people like me who heat our homes with wood stoves, pellet stoves, direct-use geothermal, and also pulp liquor, black liquor from timber mills. Now, when you take it down just to electricity, I think this is very interesting. Most people think we're Oregonians. We have this massive hydro system, and we do. It's about 44% of our electricity. But we get more of our electricity from fossil fuels, if you look at the coal and natural gas, than we do from hydro. And most of that is coming from coal-burning plants in Wyoming. This has important ramifications for a renewable energy standard, and I will come back around to why that is. So each year now we're spending about $10 billion on energy in Oregon. 85% of it's leaving the state. I don't know if any of you all have seen your electricity or natural gas prices go down, but that's not the trend. Electricity has gone up about 35% in the last 4 or 5 years. Natural gas rates at the wholesale level have gone up 168%. 94% of that has been passed on to retail consumers. And Oregon is particularly vulnerable to a dependency upon fossil fuel because while it might be the national average that we're importing 60% of our oil and about 30% of our natural gas, Oregon imports 100% of both of those things. We have virtually none of our own resources there. The cool thing, though, about this issue is within all of this very alarming, these very alarming storm clouds are some significant silver linings. And I really believe that Oregon is well positioned to become an absolute national leader in the clean energy industry. And these numbers are actually pretty conservative because when you're looking at the sustainable energy industry, you're looking at the renewable side, the people who are putting green electrons into the grid or into a home or green molecules into a tank. But you're also looking at the conservation technology side. And here in Central Oregon, we have a couple of these companies, Dent Instruments, Advanced Power. They're just companies that figure out better ways to use energy efficiently no matter where it's coming from. That sector is actually projected to be greater in revenue and job creation than renewables. Wind has been the fastest growing total sector in the energy industry globally for a number of years now. Solar seeing huge growth. You can see these slides are actually from GE. GE is getting about 8% of their revenues now from wind energy and are heavily invested.
Madam Chair, Sylvia, would you mind backing up a couple slides, please?
Tell me when.
I was just curious. Back.
Forward?
Forward. Those last two bullets, would you touch on those, please?
Yes, I'm trying to save time.
I understand, but I thought those would be interesting.
It's pretty fascinating, actually. Shell and BP have both invested heavily in renewable energies. And BP, actually, if you go to their website now, you'll see that they're no longer calling themselves British Petroleum, but they're Beyond Petroleum. And have been heavily invested in solar for a number of years, one of the leaders in it, actually. And Goldman Sachs recently purchased Horizon Wind. They're based out of Portland. Very important Oregon clean energy company. You know, and these guys might be being good corporate citizens, but they might also be realizing that there's going to be a lot of money made in this industry. And we're starting to really see a foothold of that here in Oregon. Also important, you hear on this issue, it can't be done. We can't make the conversion to sustainable energy because the costs are too high. This just shows how much the cost of wind energy has dropped over the last 20 years. It is now literally relatively cost competitive with coal, natural gas, hydro facilities straight across the board. You're seeing similar drops in all of the sustainable energy technologies. This is a little misleading because I don't want to give you the impression that, you know, a solar farm would be cost competitive with conventional energy. It's not at this point. It's a lot more expensive. But the total cost for it has come down greatly. And where solar is going to be a part of our puzzle is when we get serious about zero net energy buildings and buildings that actually become their own power plants. And some of your guys' recent work on the two tax credit related bills will help move us down that path, so that I'm really delighted. I also think it's important to realize that in all the concern about what it's going to cost us to deal with carbon emissions, there is also an enormous economic opportunity that lies within getting ahead of the carbon issue, and it happens on two fronts. One is, the first thing you do if you want to reduce your carbon footprint is you reduce your energy consumption. That's the quickest way to get to it, and companies that have done it, DuPont, 72% reduction in carbon emissions, and they're saving billions of dollars because the way they got at that was by being more energy efficient. That's the single point. The other opportunity we have in Oregon is anybody, you know, there are now, I don't know if I have this slide, I don't, yeah, Kyoto, there are now 160-some-odd countries who have signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, who have signed on to a measure to reduce carbon emissions. Any business that is doing business internationally that can create a better carbon-neutral mousetrap, whether that is actually a clean energy technology or an office table made in a more carbon-neutral manner, is going to be at an economic advantage in doing international trade. So Central Oregon is not only the coolest House district and the coolest Senate district, but we are the heart of Oregon's clean energy industry at this point. This 9-county Central Oregon corridor has a diversity of renewable energy resources unparalleled by any area of similar geographic size in the country. We have tremendous wind in the northern parts. We have terrific solar opportunities. We have biomass energy. We have a crummy growing season in Central Oregon, but it's still darn good for growing a number of the biofuel feedstocks. The whole town of Klamath Falls in Southern Oregon is geothermally powered. We are one of the 4 or 5 states in the country that actually has significant geothermal resource. And another thing, I hear that you were at the Swale Irrigation District, or
COID.
We have an unbelievable opportunity here with our irrigation canals that run the better part of the year in doing small hydro. In fact, there was an article in the paper yesterday where Swale Irrigation District is now really moving forward on a project that will generate 1 megawatt of energy. It's a really substantial piece of our energy puzzle, I think. We also, 3 Strategies runs the Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy project, and we've done some of the earliest work on trying to determine what is the state of this cluster in Oregon, this industry cluster at this point. And through that work, we've determined at least 94 clean energy companies in that Central Oregon corridor. You've met with some of them today, and some of them are here, but PV Powered, Idatech, those two especially are important players nationally and even internationally, Davenport Power. We have 2 of the most heralded, if you will, biomass projects going on. One is with the Warm Springs Forest Products, and the other is in Lakeview, and again, the Swale Irrigation Project. And then Klamath, the whole Klamath area with their geothermal power and the Oregon Institute of Technology there, has been a world leader in geothermal technologies for quite some time. This is a really exciting thing, too. In Central Oregon, we're also seeing just a tremendous amount of community leadership and excitement on this issue. BIMS 2030 is over a year-long process now of creating a really in-depth and integrated vision plan for Central Oregon, and it is just ripe with commitment to clean energy, including one of the strategies being to have Bend become a national clean energy leader. Redmond Airport and the Bend parking garage, those two are worth noting because those of us who buy the Blue Sky Power from Pacific Power, I knew you would. Pacific Power is required legally to reinvest the funds that come from Blue Sky clients into creating new renewable energy projects. And they recently had amassed enough money from that they put out bids. And of the 5 projects in the state that were funded, 2 of them were in Central Oregon. One is for a large solar array at the Redmond Airport. The other is for a solar array on the Bend parking garage. So 2 of the 5 were in Central Oregon, and they were the 2 largest of the 5 also. You're probably already hearing a lot about Juniper Ridge, and we'll continue to, but there's a lot of consensus about trying to create Juniper Ridge, this large industrial park, as a sustainable energy center of some sort. And also there's a development going on that's a working title, but the Northwest Innovation Park, which is a 250-acre industrial park located near the Redmond Airport that's just beginning to be developed, they too are wanting to be a real focus for sustainable energy. So it's coming at it from just a lot of angles here, both from the community visioning and also from some key business people who are not conventionally energy related, but are really seeing the potential for Central Oregon to become a real hub for that industry. We also have, again at the community level, we've got, I think now we're up to 7 different organizations that have come together to form a coalition, and we will be bringing you Energy Independence Month. That's in June and July. That was birthed here in Central Oregon. We just got the verbal okay. Not sure I can officially announce this, but we're likely moving down the pipeline of having the governor declare July Energy Independence Month. We'll be doing that work. And then, of course, Central Oregon has also been a leader in what is now beginning to be a statewide effort to develop a workforce and training program specifically for the clean energy industry. And that first developed from the Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy Project when we did some of the early work with Oregon Employment Department. And just recently, we were also contracted by the state now to coordinate the whole statewide workforce development work. So that's coming directly out of Central Oregon. I won't get into this. I can come back to it. This is just a slide to show you that though we may be a little state, we're doing some terrific things when it comes to clean energy. We're already 10th in the nation for wind in the ground. We're 9th in the nation for solar. Portland has the most, second only to Houston, in number of energy-related employees. But remember that first slide I showed you that showed that steady increase in demand for oil? Demand for energy in Oregon looks a lot like that. And right now, we're at a crossroads because we have a number of large coal plants that have been proposed across the Pacific Northwest as a means of dealing with that increasing demand. To bring this directly back, and I'm almost finished, to the renewable energy standard, two of the things that you're going to hear are it's difficult to do sustainable energy in Oregon because of the transmission issue. Our transmission grid is at capacity. The important thing to remember is the question that you ask there. It's not whether we're going to spend more money to build transmission. It's what we're going to spend it on. Because the reality is we are at a bottleneck. And even if we continue down the road of just adding additional coal plants in Wyoming to meet that increasing demand, we don't have transmission capacity now to be able to just hook them to the grid and feed it in. We're going to be paying for transmission one way or another. Our choice is, do we want to bring in more out-of-state fossil fuel, or do we want to harness our own homegrown renewable energy resources? The other big question that will come up is the cost issue. And again, I think it's really super important to realize that the Renewable Energy Standard bill has a cost cap. It will protect folks from any exorbitant rate increases. But the 22 other states that have had an RPS or an RES have not had that happen in one of them. They've not had rates spike because of it. And again, you need to make sure we're looking at apples and apples. The current trajectory that we're on is seeing double-digit rate increases year after year. So it could be that if we actually want to shield ratepayers from increasing prices, the single stupidest move we could make is to do nothing, is to stay here and continue with business as usual. So again, I do really want to thank you guys for your work on the two tax credit-related bills. I think that's going to be super useful on a number of fronts, both in green building as well as energy, also on the biofuels. And clearly, I think a renewable energy standard. There are now 23 states in the country that do not have that have a renewable energy standard. Oregon is not one of them. It's very important to realize that we're now surrounded by states that have them. California has one. Washington passed one last November. the two big clean energy projects that are under development now in Central Oregon, one for a geothermal plant, another one for a biomass facility in La Pine, they have power sales agreements with California companies. So if we don't move on this pretty soon, our best homegrown renewable energy resources are going to be going out of state. And that's my overview. Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvia. And thank you for, I don't know if you want to go back one slide and just let people know where those solar panels are.
Yes, indeed. Those solar panels are on the Oregon State Capitol. We were the first, and we might still be the only solar-powered capital. Are we?
Brady's shaking his head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it lights the golden man, and I don't know if there's extra energy that comes up, but it's very exciting.
Well,
if you haven't been up there yet, go visit the panels on the top of the roof. But thank you for that excellent overview, Sylvia, and I'm really pleased to know that my blue sky dollars are going to support projects here in Central Oregon.
So are we.
Very much, Madam Chair.
Question. An extra cost that we pay, a voluntary fee, you know, extra cost that we pay on, I am in Pacific Core territory, actually, not PGE. So I wanted to open up the, for questions from the panel, from my colleagues, see if there's any questions for Sylvia.
Well, so does that mean my blue sky dollars are going to support projects in your district?
I hope so.
Yeah. Any questions for Sylvia?
Madam Chair, just not very briefly. Sylvia, I think it was 2 years ago, Senator Wessel and I had the pleasure of taking your group's tour of solar homes in Bend. And could you share with the panel, I believe you've told us, or whoever was hosting the tour, that Bend that year, I believe, had 10% of the building permits, I think, were for solar homes, which is ahead of the national average. Do I recall that correctly?
I didn't say that. I'm not sure that we have that number. I'm not sure.
Okay.
You can ask Mike Rainey when he comes up about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he might know that.
But I thought it was very fascinating, you know, seeing some of these homes. I mean, I had a solar home, a passive solar home in Virginia, but the technology today is so far advanced. I thought it was very fascinating seeing these homes on the tour. I appreciated that very much.
Yeah, no, it was very good to have you. And, you know, that's just another area where Central Oregon and Oregon have had a lot of leadership, because the solar home tour started as a national effort by the American Solar Energy Society, largely through the leadership of Christopher Diamond and some others at the Oregon Department of Energy. We pulled together a collaborative Oregon effort, and Oregon now has the most developed collaborative green and solar home tour of any state in the country. So 14 communities had tours last year.
So we have a quick question for you. This has always perplexed me. I've traveled a lot around the world, and one of the things I've noticed almost everywhere except in the United States and in Northern Europe, because of the lack of sunshine actually there, is the solar hot water heaters. And I'm just really perplexed why we don't have it. I mean, you know, you can sort of say, well, we've had cheap energy for a long time, but it seems like lots of places, at a minimum, use solar to heat their hot water. And I, like many people, I mean, I use natural gas, but are heating up this hot water all day, 24 hours
a day.
It's
a slam dunk. Solar hot water in Oregon is a slam dunk. And actually, according to ODA, we do have about 18,000 residential solar water systems, but that is just really a small number compared to what we could be doing. The incentives for them are fabulous right now. You know, and the worst solar resource in Oregon, the Astoria area, still gets more capturable sunlight than most of Germany, and Germany's just kicking our butts on solar right now. So I agree with you completely. In fact, I was in a conversation yesterday with people who did another presentation. The guys got all excited about doing solar on their new homes, and I said, yeah, but you should start with hot water. That's just it's a quick payback. I did just get a message from Colleen Neal, who runs the local neighbor impact. It used to be the COCAN organization. And she's been working for a long time to try to get solar hot water heating systems implemented into the affordable housing work. And they just put up their first 8 yesterday. So that's here in Central Oregon also, and that's a pilot project that they're starting to do through the affordable housing program.
If you have any ideas in the future on how we can provide better incentives for that. I know we just, with the, you know, with the residential energy tax credit, that'll certainly help. But any other ideas you have, I think this committee would be very interested in hearing them.
I'll take that back to some of the folks on the working group and see specifically if we could target something there.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you so much for
Thank you.
Coming today. We really appreciate it. Excellent overview. Okay. So next I'm going to call up, I think, David McLean. He's going to talk about geothermal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David McLean. I'm a renewable energy development consultant. I have built over 1,000 megawatts of renewable energy in my career, about half geothermal, half others. I've done just about everything, landfill gas, biomass projects, garbage power plants, wind projects and geothermal projects, and I also did some nukes and coal back earlier in my career. And by the way, early in my career, in 1980, I converted the Capitol Mall of the state of Idaho to geothermal space heating, and that's the oldest renewable energy capital in the United States. So I'd like to talk a little bit about renewables in general, but specifically I'll get toward geothermal. I'm very broad-brushed here, what I want to get to is that petroleum-based fuel power sources cannot with any reasonable certainty forecast their fuel price beyond 3 or 5 year windows. And it's all hocus pocus that they're telling you beyond that. Geothermal power plants, biomass power plants, and wind power plants can give you stable long-term fuel rates. That's because the fuel for the energy resource is developed when the plant is built. And that can be amortized over a 10 or 15 year period. So a 6.5 cent per kilowatt hour. Early in my career, in 1980, I converted the Capitol Mall of the state of Idaho to geothermal space heating, and that's the oldest renewable energy capital in the United States. So I'd like to talk a little bit about renewables in general, but specifically I'll get toward geothermal. It's very broad-brushed here, what I want to get to is that petroleum-based fuel power sources cannot with any reasonable certainty forecast their fuel price beyond 3 or 5 year windows. And it's all hocus pocus that they're telling you beyond that. Geothermal power plants, biomass power plants, and wind power plants can give you stable long-term fuel rates. That's because the fuel for the energy resource is developed when the plant is built. And that can be amortized over a 10 or 15 year period. So a 6.5 cent per kilowatt hour power plant, geothermal power plant built in 2007 can be levelized at 6.5 cents in 2017. And so you're not going to see the price escalation in the energy price when you do these renewable power plants. So be inflation escalators. This keeps rates down. Plants, these projects, these types of technology are off the shelf. They're mature. This is not R&D. Geothermal projects and biomass projects like the one that Cal will talk about soon have a very high reliability factor. They have high capacity factors and high availability. That means of the 8760 hours a year, they're there 95% of the time at their rated capacity. That's the energy, that's the average for geothermal projects in the United States. That's a very high. No other technology meets that standard. That gives you long-term rate stability. What it gives you is reliability to the grid. It stiffens the grid. It forms a base, what they call base-loaded generation. It stiffens the grid. That, in turn, gives reliability to the grid, and again, that keeps prices stable. A resource portfolio standard in the state of Oregon would help create a greater market for new renewables in the state. Base-loaded projects are going to be needed to meet all resource portfolio standards all along the western United States. And you'll see California already looking jealously at Oregon's resources to meet their resource portfolio standards. This again requires grid stability. So the grid stability is going to look for base-loaded power plants like biomass power plants, geothermal power plants, and large wind farms that can provide grid stability. The future should rely on renewables, not fossil fuels, not carbon-based energies. Carbon-based fuels will increase costs because they cannot guarantee or give you a good, stable price structure over a 20-year horizon. What will happen is that they have to either import that fossil fuel from a foreign source, or that fossil fuel is subject to pollution credits, carbon controls, or other geopolitical issues. So Oregon has a significant wind, biomass, and geothermal renewable power resources. They're a very large resource base here. The cost of solar projects is coming down, so I would say within 5 years you're going to see a solar demonstration project, because the technology is being proven in Germany is applicable here. It's price structure and more than capital cost structure that makes these things work right now. And renewables are reliable, they're off the shelf, and they can be delivered in good time frames to meet the future growth. We need better market structure, and that's why we need the resource portfolio standard. The resource portfolio standard would be good for Oregon's economy. It would stabilize long-term price rates. It would stimulate development of these renewable resources versus coal plants in Wyoming, so you bring those jobs here. It provides lots of construction jobs, and better than that, it brings a lot of high-paid technical jobs with these projects. And most of these projects are located in rural communities. They're going to be located out in the desert. They're going to be located in eastern Oregon, not western Oregon. For example, if you just look up at the roof here, the kilowatts you're burning in this room are probably coal kilowatts. They're not renewable kilowatts. They may be mixed with some hydro. So if Central Oregon wants to be green, it should start thinking about what are the resources it can bring to the system, to the mix. I don't think you're going to find renewables are not the panacea that solves all problems. It is part of the solution of the long-term energy mix. Renewables will provide the rate stabilization that we have enjoyed in the region, similar to what we have enjoyed for the last 50 years, because we developed the hydro system. And that hydro system is a renewable resource, and it provided us 50 years of very low and stable rates. And if you're going to plan a future, you should do it with the new renewables, so you can have another 50 to 100 year planning horizon of stable price structures. And now, I want to talk about geothermal. There's lots of it. There's lots in Newberry, I think Crump Geyser area, Lakes County along Summer Lake. Over in Neal. I think there's probably almost 300 megawatts of geothermal energy that could be technically developed in the state of Oregon very readily in the next 10-year horizon if there's a proper market structure. Wind, there's several hundreds of megawatts of wind that could be developed. And it's really a matter of market opportunity so that investors can find certainty that when they build these very expensive facilities, they can get a 10 or 15 year contract that allows them to debt service that project, and they levelize that cost back and make a rate of return. And that's not going to happen in a hydro-based environment unless you can raise that rate structure up. And the way you can do that is by having a resource portfolio standard.
I have a quick question for you, Val. You said there was 300. Your estimate was 300 megawatts of geothermal in the future. What are we currently producing?
In Oregon?
Yeah, in Oregon.
Zero. Now,
because my understanding was Lakeview, and there's some geothermal being used.
We have a lot of direct use projects. We're using them for space heating throughout the state, but we have no power generation projects.
So not commercial.
There's some in the planning stage, but you need to have good long-term power contracts. And they're building geothermal power plants in Utah, Nevada, in California, and British Columbia. And they're not building them in Oregon. They're building them in Idaho. Why aren't they building them in Oregon?
I think Representative Burley has a question.
Well, Dave, I don't believe you're directly involved in the project down here on Newberry, Blueberry
yeah.
area. But just, and you know, without revealing any information that shouldn't be, but I'm just kind of curious, you know, a project like that built out, how much would that be producing? What would the cost of production of power in something like that be?
Okay. A 30-megawatt power plant built at Newberry was going to cost about $117 million in capital costs, total in. It's going to cost about $1.5 million to $2 million per well to drill. So the well field itself, or the fuel supply, is going to be a $48 or $50 million investment. And then they build the power plant and the power line on top of that to get you up to about the $117 million figure. That's going to come out as a levelized price somewhere around 6.5 to 7.5 cents, depending on how it's financed. Can I ask you your question? And there's at least 30 megawatts up there. I mean, I drilled the first two wells up there, so I don't have any financial or consulting involvement in that area right now, but I can tell you there's a significant heat resource up there, and it's just a matter of taking the risk and exploring the wells.
Well, it's 6.5 to 7 cents a kilowatt. I mean, that's pretty competitive with some of the avoided costs that I'm hearing today. Is that accurate?
It's getting close. It's getting close. Without production tax credits, I don't think you can make it. You have to have the production tax credits to make the economics work. Production tax credits are an animal that Congress renews every 2 years. So you go to the bank and you're under construction, say, I'm not going to make it by December 23rd, 2008. And they go, well, maybe we won't have a loan. So that's one of the big changes in the structure of the market has to be fixed is production tax credits. But resource portfolio standards are enhancing the marketplace, particularly in California and Nevada, because there's going to be there's a demand that has to be fulfilled. So you have the energy suppliers starting to look for renewable projects, and they'll start looking at the lowest cost ones first, and then they'll fill in their portfolio, and then they'll get to the higher cost ones. There's a natural progression to go there, and that's good. It's good economics to do it that way. I would think that projects like geothermal project, baseload projects are going to come in Oregon somewhere between 6.5 and 8.5 cents per kilowatt hour over the next 10-year horizon. That's going to be the price structure. They're going to be baseloaded and very reliable.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next we have Greg Patterson from PV Power. He's going to talk about solar energy. Thanks for hosting us this morning.
Well, thank you, Madam, and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to show you PV Power. I realize it's probably one of the best-kept secrets in Central Oregon in terms of a renewable energy company. We're going to try to change that, and we're doing some great things. So real quickly, let me just do a quick intro for those that don't know about PV Power. We've been around about 4 years. We make grid-tied inverters, which convert DC from a solar array to AC that you can ship back onto the utility grid or use in a home or a factory. So I wanted to do a couple things. Just one, I want to thank Sylvia for a great intro. She framed the market opportunity very well. So I'll talk a little bit and try to be additive to some of the insights she shared and more focused on solar PV, photovoltaic in particular. So one of the things that I want to make sure the committee understands is that solar energy is great from both an environmental policy, but both from a fiscal and business policy. There has been a tremendous turnaround in kind of the core investment trends. And if you look at the hottest sector in investment capital, it is in renewables. And where in the past investment would flow when the price of oil went high and decline when it went low, you were seeing a fundamental market shift that the investment capital flowing into renewables and solar in particular has absolutely been sustained, even as, until very recently, the price of oil has actually been dropping. So if you look at the broad worldwide investment capital flows, we really are viewing renewable energy as a market that's here for the long term. The confidence is tremendously high. So it is not a cyclical market. It's about building the infrastructure to deal with what Sylvia very well articulated is the fundamental challenges at a state, country, and global level. So it is clearly the time to act and to align with what is that collective wisdom. So the other thing I want to talk about is, real quickly, the lessons that we can learn from California, which is the kind of the lead market in the U.S. They have done some things very, very well on how do you literally trigger and catalyze the kind of growth and scale that I think specifically the solar industry needs to truly get to that break-even point. And that break-even point where PV-generated electricity is literally, most people would say, between 5 and 12 years out. The uncertainty on that 5 to 12 years is based on a lot of things. One, as Sylvia showed, it's awful hard to predict out what is the baseline electricity generating cost going to be. Many of you have probably heard that the U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of coal. And coal is the benchmark in terms of cost per kilowatt. But not factored into that is several things. One, the environmental impact of that coal. It's also the dirtiest energy generating as of now. And there's lots of money flowing into how to clean that up. But it's going to add cost to that coal. The second thing, if you project out the coal prices that translate to the benchmark cost per kilowatt, projections show that we've got about 8 years of coal that's that easy to access before you start going into a significant increase in cost per ton. So there's a lot of factors around base level energy prices that, as Sylvia said, are going to continue to drive that cost per energy unit higher and higher and on a relatively exponential scale, because there isn't a lot of solutions. So it's one of the things that is causing the investment community to focus so much on renewables, because they see those trends, they believe those trends, and they're also absolutely betting that carbon trading and other forms of free market mechanisms to capture the cost to the environment are going to start coming online. So let me go back down to, real quickly, what I think some of the lessons that we can learn from California. What have they done well, and where is there opportunities to do better and learn from them? The thing that I really want to reinforce is the renewable energy portfolio standard. It's one of the things that I think California has initiated and has done well. And I'll describe for you what I've seen and what has that done in terms of helping to very constructively and efficiently, being a long-term business person myself, influence markets. So currently, PV Powered is working with Boeing and are developing a proposal to go after about a 500-megawatt facility in Southern California, a big solar farm. The renewable energy portfolio is catalyzing that discussion and the bid. It is bringing the best and brightest minds together and focusing on how do you do large installations, because that is the scale at which you're going to get the most efficient opportunity and drive innovation very effectively that will ultimately cascade down to residential and distributed power generating solutions. So those kinds of high-level standards catalyze, I think, a very constructive and efficient response in the market, companies like us and Boeing and a lot of our competitors. It's giving us the drive to innovate because they are pushing very hard. They don't want to charge a premium to their ratepayers. They don't want to pay extra for this. So it's giving us meaty projects to develop the technology and the scale that we can do it relatively early in this life cycle for this industry to really prove out what we can do. And all of those innovations will cascade down to smaller and smaller so that we can kind of bring it to other and other areas. So Oregon joining in and participating, and from a solar perspective, Central Oregon is an ideal environment. We can do these pilot projects, and we can leverage it, and we can build and reinforce our own industries, be it over in Beaverton, the solar world, or here locally with the companies like PV Powered in Central Oregon. So I really want to reinforce that there's some tremendous ways where government can show leadership that ultimately is going to drive jobs, economic growth, and efficient use of capital now and for the next 20 to 30 years. The other thing that I think we need to focus on, and Sylvia mentioned this as well, is the, and thanks to the folks that have been driving this, is this business energy tax credit and the residential tax credit. It provides the catalyst to help companies like PV Powered truly innovate and get positioned for success on world markets. PV Powered, as I mentioned to you, is literally looking at how do we rapidly grow overseas. We're exploring how do we get into markets that are equally as compelling. And just one other data point. If you have not been reading about, but China is probably the best textbook case of if we do nothing, what will we look like? I don't know if any of you have visited China. It is an incredibly polluted.
Yes.
It is, they are realizing at a fundamental level now, finally the government, that their path is the path to ruin. They are truly losing huge crops. They're having fundamental, huge investments in government spending just to deal with the environmental damage. And they're moving fast. They were slow. They get it now. We're getting a lot of pull to try to move into China just to help deal with that. The engine is cranked up. And if I could point to any country that we really want to look to say if we do nothing, what will we start looking like? It's China. And it's scary. So, with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony. And I will just add, colleagues, I went to China for the first time in 1988, and I visited it again 3 years ago, and I was absolutely shocked about the changes and the increase in pollution. And part of it is, with a billion people, you have a growing middle class that was not there before, and you're having a huge demand for increase in energy. I mean, you have people who now, everybody wants, rightly so, a TV and a refrigerator and all the stuff that we have in this country. And guess what? You need a lot of power to provide for all those products. And they burn an awful lot of coal. I think it's 200 new coal plants a year, I've read in the New York Times. And we had a story recently talking about all the particulate matter that we're actually... the transboundary project that does monitoring, looking at increase in particulates, and they have traced, they're tracing it back, mostly coming from China.
It is one planet. It's the only one we got. Yep. And there's no walls.
The question I have for you is, are you familiar with the RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard that was passed in California? I'm just curious how, I know there's about 20 of them around the country.
It's very similar to what is being proposed in Oregon. It is also at a 25% standard right now, is what California is also trying to go after.
Thank you.
And they've got, I think it's 2020, or I can't remember, it's 2020 or 2025.
And
similar kinds of growth.
And I know, again, we're not having a hearing on the bill, but just to remind my colleagues on the committee, the Senate bill is proposing 25% by 2025 here in Oregon, just to give you some perspective. So, are there any questions?
Okay.
Senator, I defer to you, Senator.
Of course.
Well, we always defer to our senior members.
Are you going to stand for that?
Whose side of the building this 373 is on? Greg, you mentioned some of the good things California did. And you indicated there were some lessons we could learn that where maybe they didn't do things so well. Could you enumerate some of those just so we don't?
You bet. And I would love to come to Salem and spend more time and share with that. I am been in this industry ultimately about 6 months and leading PV Power at about 3.5. So I want to acknowledge I'm still on a learning curve. But some of the things that they have done, it is always with the best of intents, but often without clear thinking through of all the unintended consequences. So they have launched the California Solar Initiative that went into effect January. Two things that we don't want to do. They did not have that thought out and fully defined when it was supposed to turn over. So they've left the California industry dangling on a multitude of projects that is creating fear, confusion, and doubt from end customers and the demand side through all of the components of the value chain that need to deliver it on both a residential and commercial. So being working up front on the details and thinking those through before we turn go to implementation is something we should learn. That's first. And I really believe clear forums where you can bring industry and user segments and key stakeholders, utilities and others, is the way to do that. The second thing they have done is there's a strategic decision when you get to some of the incentives. If I would kind of broadly characterize them between paying for the promise of energy generation or paying for the actual performance and delivery of energy. California has had, it has been very successful in stimulating the market, the paying for the capacity. And I think rightfully, they are trying to migrate to a pay for performance so that instead of paying somebody upfront on what is the possible energy you can generate, which is not a bad early start as you're trying to get in because it's a very simple process. They hadn't thought through how do you really put in the logistical infrastructure to deal with transactions and payments on a month-to-month basis of who's generating it. And I'll use a residential example. They are struggling with how do they just put in place the ability to write checks monthly to companies and residents that want to go to a true performance-based. In other words, no upfront rebate or tax incentive. You just get for every kilowatt hour so much money. So we do not want to, again, move forward into that. I think performance-based is from a fundamental market-driven state, I think, the best approach. It is truly paying and rewarding companies and consumers that would become then generators for the actual power they can generate, and you would reinforce and incent to those that have the best opportunity. The example, just to clarify, because I see, is whether you lived in cloudy San Francisco or the Central Valley of California, you could think of very different solar environments. They would have gotten the same upfront incentive to put that solar system on their house. And for us, you could think about we would want to have incentives that truly put the solar installations and energy-generating facilities where there's going to be the most efficient form to generate.
Representative Burley has
you.
A question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greg, this performance notion, is this similar to the net metering?
Yes, that is also termed a net metering.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. Madam Chair, if I may. I have a couple others. Greg, one is, would you please elaborate for us what Solar World, what that investment is and what they're going to be producing and how that fits into the equation?
Yes, Solar World is a German company that has just bought a facility in Beaverton and are going to be moving a large kind of solar module manufacturing facility there. They're targeting it should be the largest one in the U.S. Solar World worldwide, I believe, is top three in terms of solar panel capacity in manufacturing output. So very credible company. Great to have them in Oregon. As I look at it, it gives us a very strategic business base to try to build a renewable energy portfolio coming out of Oregon. So, again, it's a very the neat thing about them and what we do here. It is clean manufacturing, very little negative waste streams. And, again, it delivers, I think, a tremendous amount of credibility to the state. Does that answer your question?
Very much so, yes.
Can I do one follow-up to yours? Because my understanding, and I think it's in Hillsboro, because they...
Oh, it is. You're right. It is Hillsboro.
An existing facility.
Yes.
A vacant facility. I thought, and I read this in the paper, so it isn't necessarily true. Sorry to all my friends.
No.
Yeah. In the
media.
Journalistic world.
Local party exception.
Yeah, local party exception, of course. I always read the Ben bulletins. We get it at the Capitol. As far as, I thought they were manufacturing chips. Are they actually manufacturing panels there?
I believe they are at least manufacturing the chips. Again, my information may not be accurate. I thought they were going to go to a actual panel output eventually. Maybe it is in a phased way.
And that, my understanding is over 1,000 jobs that
yes.
are going to be brought there.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And if I may,
yeah.
One last question, Greg. And Sylvia actually brought this up a little bit, but you know, you of course have got your workforce involved in your R&D and your manufacturing, but there's a broader workforce involved, particularly with solar, because whether it's a hot water system or the electrical system. And could you touch upon that for us in the context of how's the workforce look today? Where do we need to be tomorrow? What type of resources do we need to help develop that workforce and bring that forward?
Okay, very, very good question. And I really will talk about from a value chain. I'll try to talk beyond just what I do and Solar World does. But let me start there, because that's at the headwaters of this value chain. You literally have the panels or modules that capture the photons and convert them to DC. That is going to require engineering and design expertise ongoing. You're going to have sophisticated manufacturing methods and processes that you're going to have to manufacture those. You're going to have employees able to, with skilled, thing or classic high-tech manufacturing skill sets that you're going to need to do that. I will have the same thing on the inverter side, and the two most significant components of any solar system, residential or commercial, is the panels and the inverters. And both of those have relatively high-skilled manufacturing processes and skill sets, as well as appropriate R&D and design skill sets to support, from materials engineering to power electronics, software, firmware, and there's also a large growing interest in online services and business models, because you need to track and ultimately connect all these systems you'd like to the Internet. It helps the net metering. You want to be able to do those transactions on the backbone of an Internet that allows that to be a very efficient transaction. It also provides lots of data for utility planning, because as distributed power generation comes on board, utility companies need to start figuring out how do you strategically and empirically plan power generation when it could be coming from 10,000 rooftops across the state. How do you plan that, which is a very different model from a centralized? So you need an Internet-based set of models and skills in addition to classic manufacturing skills. Next thing, how do you get those things deployed? You've got my inverters. You've got SolarWorld's panels. There's significant design talent to how do you put it on a, make it a solar farm in southeastern Oregon, or put it on a big Intel factory on the west side. You got to design that system. You got to factor it into, one, the facility you're going to be feeding or the utility you're going to be feeding, and you got to make sure that installation and design are done very efficiently and effectively. Then you're going to have to maintain and support those facilities, be it 10,000 rooftops of residences or that major solar farm out in the central Oregon. And those will require some specialized skills as well. But all of those jobs, I think, are generally trade jobs and relatively very value jobs to our local economy. And one of the challenges that I would tell you right now, the biggest bottleneck in California growth used to be panels. That has been solved by this investment capital flowing. It is the people that install the darn things. It is so hard, and the labor shortages of trained, skilled people, the electrical trades, the construction trades, are huge. So this is a tremendously positive, absolute living wage value chain. There are skills necessary, and it will be one of the biggest challenges, but it's a great challenge. You're generating demand for labor, skilled labor.
I can ask a follow-up question to Representative Burley regarding training. I mean, where in Oregon, if somebody wants to learn these trades or get training to do the installation, where would they get that?
I'd say I would say you'd want to go really focus this, and I'm trying to explore with OSU and other large campuses, how do I get the design and engineering side covered? But for a lot of the trades and so forth, and that's where the majority of bodies will come in manufacturing, the local community colleges, there's so many educational institutions that I think you can start building this out. And very quickly, I think we...
It is the people that install the darn things. It is so hard, and the labor shortages of trained, skilled people, the electrical trades, the construction trades, are huge. So this is a tremendously positive, absolute living wage value chain. There are skills necessary, and it will be one of the biggest challenges, but it's a great challenge. You're generating demand for labor, skilled labor.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question to Representative Burley regarding training. Where in Oregon, if somebody wants to learn these trades or get training to do the installation?
where would they get that?
I'd say, I would say you'd want to go really focus this, and I'm trying to explore with OSU and other large campuses, how do we get the design and engineering side covered? But for a lot of the trades and so forth, and that's where the majority of bodies will come in manufacturing. The local community colleges, there's so many educational institutions that I think you can start building this out. And very quickly, I think we need to start thinking, how do you do what I would call an ecosystem approach to building this industry? And again, there's so much to be learned from watching the stresses and strains and the successes and failures of California. They are ahead of everybody right now.
Madam Chair, if you would indulge me, and at the risk of putting Lance on the spot, there's a gentleman in back actually involved in the electrical trades that might want to touch on this a little bit, if you wouldn't mind.
Certainly. Would you like to come up, sir? And I know that, Greg, I know you have to leave.
I've got 5 minutes, okay. And then after I will do a graceful exit.
Right. We have several other people that want to testify. So is it Lance?
Yes.
Do you want to come up to the microphone? And just if you want to add a few words to answer that question, I think it would be very valuable for the committee to hear. And you could state your name.
I'm sorry to put
record.
You on the spot.
Sure.
I thought it would be a good opportunity.
Yeah.
You bet. I'm Lance Zifka. I'm with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280. And we have a continuing education training program. And so what happens is with all of our journeyman electricians, we have to have so many hours of continuing ed to keep our license. And one of the things we are actually starting to do, we've been doing it for a couple of years, is solar installations. So, and we have classes actually in Central Oregon and in Valley on doing solar installations. But right now, we haven't, you know, the technology is changing so fast that our classes right now are fairly basic. So it's, you know, an inverter and panels, and it's code related and some hands-on training at the same time to put the system in.
Yeah, I'd reinforce that. This is still an immature industry. It's changing fast. I've spent a huge amount of my time in just the last 3.5 months on this job getting up to speed on what are the emerging standards, be it at the literally how do you connect these things together, to what are the UL and OSHA regulations necessary to assure that you hook into utilities and maintain safety. So there's lots of things. It's a dynamic space, and it's part of where the training and the support needs to be thought through.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Having talked to a couple of folks doing solar panel installs in the Portland area, I know one of the challenges is that until this industry gets big enough that it can provide ongoing work, they face the challenge of bringing on workers for a few months or a couple of projects, and then there will be a spell of a few months where there's nothing, so then they have to find new folks to get retrained or to get trained for the first time. Is that your experience down here as well?
Yeah, we actually have one contractor in this area. It's called New Path Renewables, and they actually work all over the world doing design and installs, and they've done some locally and stuff, but they have that same exact problem. The workforce just continue, you know, one day they have a couple projects, and like you say, 6 months down the road, those guys are gone because they don't have anything. Another problem that unfortunately arises is we have inspectors that inspect all these installations, and since it's such a new technology, we have a real problem with all the inspectors actually figuring out the code and reading it the same, and it is a, you know, real big problem there too. So.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and it's what I see. If we what has plagued solar, it has always been the investment in activity and employment has been pegged to the short-term cost of oil. It's part of where you're seeing such a different view is that the investment community is no longer worried about the short-term cost of oil. They're convinced the long-term cost.
And so, my understanding with the renewable energy standard, that will help fill in those peaks and valleys.
Exactly. Both the renewable energy standard, the BETSI and the RETSI, are things that, when implemented, will provide the market confidence to build sustainable capabilities. So those are the things that will really help build a real market and real jobs that people can count on. And thus, both living wage communities and the revenue streams.
Well, thank you, Greg. I know you have to go. We really appreciate you coming here. Thank you, Lance, for coming up unaware that you would be called up.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear from Cal Mukamoto from the Warm Springs Forest Products. He's going to talk about biomass. Well, committee members, I expect you're going to remember all this when we do have the hearing on Senate Bill 373, which I'm really pleased that we're able to have the luxury of having this overview before hearing the bill.
Is yours 873?
Yours 873.
Your RPS bill?
Yeah, but, no. Proprietary.
Yeah.
At the end of the day,
right. Thank you. Thanks for being here, and for the record, if you can state your name.
My name is Cal Mukamoto. I'm the manager for Warm Springs Biomass LLC, which is the developer for the Warm Springs biomass electricity project. It's totally owned by the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Thank you, Madam Chairman, Vice Chair Representative Burley, committee members, and, of course, Senator Westland. I appreciate this time to come and speak to you about my project. Oops, hit the wrong one. Okay. Go. As you know, we have a growing problem in Central Oregon. Chuck, Representative Burley, is quite familiar with this because he's been working around here for quite a while. But we have a growing problem in that we have forests that are becoming quite overstocked. The Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council a few years ago did a study in this area and found that 31% of Deschutes National Forest is at risk of abnormally high risk from large stand replacement insect and disease outbreaks and wildfires. And largely this is because we've been over the last 100 years suppressing fires and allowing those to grow in. The COIC report also reported that over 740,000 acres in Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties are in what we call condition class 2 and 3. That means they've missed 2 to 3 fire intervals. I keep hitting the wrong one. I'm going to have to figure this one out. The reservation has been affected by the fire situation. Well, since 1996, the Confederate tribes have had 5 fires cross the borders between Forest Service and the reservation. And of these 5 fires, 10,000 acres have burned on the reservation. I'm going to get this figured out yet. In addition to that, we've had these trees growing, and on the high country, we're starting to see massive mountain pine beetle infestations. This is just a little map from the current U.S. Forest Service data. It shows the extent the mountain pine beetle infestation along the high country on the west side of the reservation, bordering the U.S. Forest Service. As a tool, the tribe has decided that in 2008, the Confederate tribes will co-locate a biomass energy plant at the Warm Springs mill site. It'll be a direct combustion cogeneration plant, basic technology. The plant will produce a net 15.5 megawatt of renewable power for sale on the grid. That's enough electricity for 15,000 homes. We consider this a new biomass market in the area. We want it to be a market pathway for forest restoration and fuels reduction. Basically, to put it real easily here, we'll take unhealthy stands, thin them, take the material, either run them through a small log plant to make lumber out of, or use the small material, grind it, burn it, and create electricity. Pretty simple. Oops. I did something. Okay.
If you look at the a project such as this, there are four sides of an investor-ready project. One is permits, the other is transmission, but most importantly in biomass plants, we really have to consider the fuel supply and the market, and that's where the RPS is going to help. If you can answer these four questions for an investor satisfactorily, you'll have an investor-ready project. There we go. Type of fuel, sir, what's that?
I'll ask you a quick question on that slide. When you're talking about fuel supply, what is the minimum length of contract that you would need in order for your plant to pencil out? In other words, what's the optimal sort of contract length?
The optimal contract length for our plant right now would be between 15 and 20 years with the federal government. Of course, you know, with smaller suppliers like private lands or urban wood suppliers, we go much shorter. But the investor really wants to see some long-term commitments and wants to see some long-term movement in providing that fuel.
Thank you.
The type of fuel sources that we're dealing with in Central Oregon are forest fuel treatments or forest restoration, juniper removal, forest residuals, which are leftovers from logging operations, small sawmill residuals, which is sawdust, etc., and clean urban wood, which is landfill diverted, clean urban wood diverted from landfills. Looking at the kilowatt cost of these fuels, you look at it, the most expensive, unfortunately, is the forest fuels, which can be up to about 4.9 cents per kilowatt. The least expensive fuels are going to be from such sawmill residuals because it's right there at the plant. And the clean urban wood ranges from a cent to 3.5 cents, depending on where it's coming from. If you look at a typical biomass plant, electricity sales right now is between... Yeah, Chuck.
Madam Chair, if I could... would you flip back, Cal,
sure.
Slide, please? Madam Chair, I just want to call it to the committee's attention. This is one of the reasons why in the biofuels bill I had the language added in for the biomass producers, because the cost of getting this previously non-commercial material out of the woods is very heavily laden with the cost of transportation alone, and we needed to help try to offset that cost to make these projects competitive on a production cost basis. So... that's why we wanted to make sure we had that in the biofuels bill.
Exactly.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Okay, getting back to the typical biomass plant on a kilowatt basis, we're seeing electricity prices without the RPS at 5.5 to 6.5 cents. Operations maintenance for these type of plants are between 2 to 3 cents per kilowatt. Fuels have to be between 2 to 2.5 cents. Just because of the price we get. And in order to create a sufficient return to justify investor risk and return, we have to rely on things such as tax credits, the Betsy, the production tax credit, and then state benefit programs. In our case, we're going to be trying to sell to one of the major IOUs in the state, such as the Energy Trust. And in fact, what we're waiting for is to see how the Energy Trust can help us. They've been great to us. Without the RPS, we have to rely on those state benefit programs. The benefits, I'm going to go through a few slides just talking about the benefits of woody biomass power. That's going to tie into why I think we're underpriced right now. The benefits of woody biomass power on the energy production benefits is, one, it can create jobs. Our current estimates are about 4.9 jobs per megawatt produced. In our plant ourselves, our plan is going to have about 16 people, and the rest are going to be transportation and logging employment. As Dave McClain pointed out, biomass is a base load or dispatchable energy source. We will have a high reliability. We're hoping to be in the 90% and above. We will avoid emissions from fossil fuel energy production. In other words, if you compare our emissions to a fossil fuel production, for example, we did a carbon study, we could offset, if we were compared offsetting a natural gas plant, about 73,000 tons of carbon a year. So that's significant. We also, I mean, as we all looking for, we're looking for increased energy diversity and security. From a forest level benefits, woody biomass can be the market for woody biomass can be used to facilitate improved forest health, improved watershed production and quality, reduced emissions from open burning of forest residues, and this is actually quite significant. Open burning produces as much as 100 times more conventional pollutants than controlled combustion or gasification. So because it isn't controlled, Chuck knows this, or Representative Burley knows this. Living in Bend, we get a lot of smoky days. I'm sure you know that in the Willamette Valley. And then, of course, reduced emissions from catastrophic wildfires. Finally, in another area we're doing landfill diversions of clean urban wood waste. One landfill burial of clean urban wood biomass consumes available landfill space and produces greater quantities of greenhouse gas emissions than controlled combustion of the diverted material. In other words, there are worse greenhouse gases produced when you do dump it, leave it into the landfill, such as methane, which is considered about 25%, or 25 times worse than regular carbon dioxide. In 1999, Greg Morris for National Renewable Energy Lab did a paper on biomass energy, and he did an average looking at the environmental benefits. It's just the environmental benefits back in 1999. And averaged about 11.4 cents of public benefits from environmental services. And this is not to include rural jobs, economic development, security, et cetera. So when you look at it without tax credits, et cetera, that takes about 7 cents to 9 cents per kilowatt needed to establish a biomass plant. So that's actually looks like a good public buy. Another study by the University of Washington showed that if you treat high-risk acres, you can avoid costs of $1,400 per acre. Treat moderate-risk acres, you can avoid costs of $600 per acre. As a biomass plant developer, my major challenges right now are, and we're moving straight ahead, is to develop a fair power purchase agreement, which can somewhat reflect some of the benefits we're going to create. Without the RPS, it's much more difficult. And creating long-term fuel supply agreements with federal agencies. As I said before, we'd like to see 15 to 20 years if possible. Right now, the longest is 10 years. Policies that we see as beneficial, the Betsy increase is going to very much help our project. We thank you for your activity on that. Renewable portfolio standard, although it probably won't benefit our project, it will benefit projects in the future. Biomass transportation assistance, as presented in 2210. State benefit programs such as the Energy Trust of Oregon. Right now, we find that to be critical in the lack of an RPS. And then any support that can be given to extension and parity of federal production tax credits. Right now, Senator Gordon Smith has a bill on the federal side that's asking for parity. That will make these biomass plants very palatable to investors. Thank you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much hope that on our next trip to Central Oregon, we get an opportunity to see this biomass facility. And I ask that question, or I mention that, partly because, to my mind, it's sort of hard for me to picture how this works. You're combusting wood to create energy without producing much in the way of emissions. And so without spending a lot of time, can you tell us a little bit more about, and I, at risk of boring members of the committee who have seen it or know it, can you tell us how the technology works?
Well, our technologies, we have, first off, it all starts in the mix of the material that's put into the plant, and this is something that I'm not a boiler technician, but first off, our boiler swirls the material around and creates as much complete combustion as possible. It is then taken through several multi-clones that drop out as much particular matter as possible, finally comes out through a ESP, electric static precipitator, which is charged and pulls the material out, any particulate matter. And because of the controlled combustion, the ability to control the complete combustion, we can lower the harmful outputs of the plant. As far as opacity ratings, we're probably between 1 and 2% on our current plant. You can't even see the smoke in the plant. Plus, another thing that we do is we don't want to burn things like tires and plastics and those things. We keep this to wood.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thanks so much, Kelly. Okay. Appreciate coming here.
Thank you.
We would certainly love to come by, and that might be a good interim.
We will make
visit.
That happen.
Yeah, we definitely would like to. So I hope you'll remember that. That we're inviting ourselves to come in.
You're not inviting yourself. You're inviting.
Appreciate
just
that.
Like, no.
Okay. Thank you. And next we're going to hear from Steve Johnson, who's going to talk about hydropower. And colleagues, really appreciate the tour we got this morning of the Fish Green. I'm sorry we couldn't make it down to the hydropower facility, but we were stretched for time. So now you can give us the virtual tour.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Steve Johnson, Manager of Central Oregon Irrigation District. And there's not always a lot of sexy things about running an irrigation district, but I would say I'm welcome the opportunity to talk about hydropower this afternoon. And I should also mention that it's a lot warmer in this room than where we were this morning. With this packet that's being distributed to you, there was an article in the Bend Bulletin on Thursday. It should be on the back part of your paperclip material. And there's a picture of if you had gone in the plant, what it would look like. So I'd urge you to read that article. It was written by a local reporter, and she was on the tour with us today, Pete Ramsay. Want to talk mainly about the potential, but also use the frame of reference of our existing hydropower plant for frame of reference. Talked about the renewable portfolio standard, also the pollution that's associated with burning fossil fuel to generate electricity. Our plant, the existing 5.5 megawatt plant, since it's been online in 1989, per year saves the equivalent of 4,000 tons of coal. And so for the life of its plant, it has saved the burning of 68,000 tons of coal. Or 1.3 billion cubic feet of natural gas. So even though we say it's small, the cumulative effect of year after year being able to provide pretty significant baseload power to the grid, it's significant. It adds up. You take all of these different industries or the aspects of these renewable energies presented to you this afternoon, and collectively it's going to have significant impact. So there's a little colored map in the front of your packet. Present this to you, Jan Lee, the manager at Swallow Irrigation District. Couldn't be here today, but she gave me full power and authority to say whatever I wanted about her project. The map, if you can tell from the colors, from the bottom of the map, the Swallow Canal runs from that lower left corner all the way to the north, where it changes to a red line and then a little star, the Swally Plant Hydro Plant. They're actually going to be constructing the pipeline in two phases. The red line represents the first phase, at the end of which will be the plant, and then next year, phase two, which extends back to their diversion point in the north part of Bend. Once completed, this plant will generate 1 megawatt of capacity. There is a little fact sheet after this map. The significant portion to the right is the COID plant hydroplant. You can see that we're actually going to be located within a mile of each other. And it's significant, the topography as well as the water rights associated with irrigation are what's significant here in combination. The elevation drop between Bend to Redmond is nearly 700 feet. So you combine that with the predictable water flow from the irrigation diversions. With that elevation, that's why you're going to be able to harness this power. It's being diverted for irrigation purposes, and it'll just run through a turbine and come back out the other side. And at the front of this, of course, is a fish screen that's similar to the one you saw this morning. It's actually a little bit more advanced with a little bit smaller holes, but it performs its environmental specifications properly. The Central Oregon Hydro Plant will be done in multiple phases over many years. The first phase, though, will be from that dark blue line you have on that map. basically if Cooley Road was extended east to our canal, that's where we would begin the piping and go through the where it exists, through the heart of the Juniper Ridge area, up to the northern edge. And we would have a facility that begins production at a 3.3 megawatt level. As we mentioned, the elevation loss, if we were to eventually pipe back to our diversion point similar to Swally, we would generate in excess of 7 megawatts. The another important aspect with both the Swally and the COID irrigation hydropower facilities is that the canals in which we transmit this irrigation water loses a lot of water through the seepage. And so when you pipe and harness it for power, you're also conserving water. And you're not going to have to divert that from the river anymore because you're leaving it where it was or where it should be. And so per mile on our Pilot Butte Canal, we lose approximately 10 cubic feet per second. So if we were actually able to pipe from our diversion down to where our planned hydro is, it would be 60 CFS of conserved water for the stream. Our pipe would be 2.25, but approximately 20 is where we'd start. The reason why I'm mentioning that is, as far as capability, if someday we were able to pipe all the way to Redmond, we would be adding 7.5 more megawatts on top of the 3.3 that we would be starting with. And significant amount of conserved water would go in stream as well. Basically, with hydro, it doesn't necessarily have to be river water either. You have any place you have water in a pipe that's going downhill, in one form or another, you're going to be able to harness that power. We have cities, like the city of Bend, that has significant water transmissions. It's my understanding they have recognized between 1 to 4 megawatt generating capacity just with the infrastructure that they have in the ground. So hydropower, it's very proven technology. It's been around for over 100 years. The question is it affordable? Can you produce, can you construct the facilities to produce the power? And that's where I wanted to thank this committee and the House for passing House Bill 2211. As you may recall, I testified in support of that bill, and I want to thank you for passing that. But I'll take advantage of Senator Westland being here because I know they'll be looking at that soon. There are two significant portions of that bill that to keep in mind, particularly with public entities generating renewable power. With the business energy tax credit, the existing BETSI has the pass-through tax credit capability, and that will be important to keep that, as well as the increased size of the projects and their capital costs. And one thing to mention to you, oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Representative Burley.
Speaking about the tax credits, would a project like this qualify for the federal production tax credits? Does that apply to small project hydro like this? Do you know?
It would if it's online before it expires, and that was one of the points made by panelists here before me. It right now is extended 1 year, but if you're not online by December 23, 2008, you can't count on it. Unfortunately, at the federal level, it's been an on again, off again, and you can't really count on it unless you're already in that window and you know you can make it.
Okay, thank you.
One last point. It already expressed support for the Senate Bill 373. Hydropower is included in that. So it has equal standing with all the other renewables. I think that's important. As I mentioned, it's a package of all these together that will have the impact. And I know this committee will be seeing a bill, House Bill 2785, if I have that correct. I would characterize it as facilitating on the state side process for approval similar to the federal level. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission provides what's called a conduit or an exemption process. Now, the exempt is somewhat of a misnomer. What it does is it recognizes that there are projects that are smaller in nature and are less complicated to evaluate. And so you're able to go through a not necessarily streamlined, but a shortened process. And so that bill addresses the ability for projects to be able to be approved similar to the federal process, and we just don't have that available yet in the state of Oregon. And that's the end of my comments.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Talk a little bit about transmission. I mean, we could have been asking everybody on Ocala's got, you know, they've got transmission concerns they're having to deal with. But, you know, tell us about the transmission capacity and what you have to do and wheeling costs and all that type of stuff. You know, who do you sell the power to and how do you get it there?
Yeah. Well, there's several components. You saw Cal's slide that had those four different components. That applies with any energy project. I'll speak specifically about the two projects, the Swally and COID proposed, but they'll follow a similar path to our existing facility. And the difference between the late 80s and
questions? Representative Burley.
Steve, talk a little bit about transmission. I mean, we could have been asking everybody. I know Cal's got, you know, they've got transmission concerns they're having to deal with. But, you know, tell us about the transmission capacity and what you have to do and wheeling costs and all that type of stuff. You know, who do you sell the power to and how do you get it there?
Yeah. Well, there's several components. You saw Cal's slide that had those four different components. That applies with any energy project. I'll speak specifically about the two projects, the Swally and COID proposed, but they'll follow a similar path to our existing facility. And the difference between the late 80s and the 2000s that we're in right now is that the Public Utility Commission adopted under docket UM 1129 a more straightforward off-the-shelf way to find your contract terms as well as your pricing. You always have the option of having a private contract versus, say, a PUC contract. And that's the way we had to negotiate directly with PacifiCorp with our existing contract. The amount of time that had to be spent for a private contract is dramatically higher and longer than if you can use the PUC contract.
Excuse me, if I could ask for clarification, when you're referring to the PUC contract, are you referring to a PERPA contract?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay,
it was for
you.
Qualified facilities.
Okay, thank you.
And can you for folks who don't want to know what PERPA is, some of us do, but we have some folks. Can you just explain the two-minute explanation?
Sure. What I recall is that it was passed in the 70s, and it was intended to require privately owned utilities such as Idaho Power, PGE, and PacifiCorp, require them to buy renewable energy and put it on the grid. And that was passed, I believe, in 1978. And with that federal legislation, it was left up to each state to define exactly how they wanted to construct that. And I apologize if this isn't technically correct, but this is just how I remember it. And so each state had established different standards for what they called a qualified facility, and it was qualified to sell power, if you will, to the private utilities. And in the state of Oregon, up until last year, you were the PERPA contracts were only available up to 1 megawatt in size. That has now been changed from 1 megawatt up to 10. And that was very significant. The avoided cost schedule process is very convoluted and that changes on an annual basis. And that had been referred to earlier here today. It's still a little low, if you will. But that's where I believe the renewable portfolio standard will kick in and provide additional value that the private utilities will look for if someone is able to bring them renewable power. So your avoided price schedule might be 5.5 or 5.8 cents at the beginning of your contract, but when you include the environmental attributes of the
renewable portfolio standard requirements, if you will, from the state of Oregon that will enhance its value. And then I think it'll be reflected in the contractual prices that the facilities get.
But going back, if I may, Madam Chair, going back to the question, though, Steve, whether you have a PURPA contract or a private one, which would be where you negotiate the price because it's not a qualifying facility, the question, though, I'm curious about is how do you actually get it from your generator to the grid? Do you build your own power line, or do you wheel it across a co-op's line or Pacific's line, or how do you do that?
You have to work hand-in-hand with the utility company. They'll have a standard for where you want to bring power to their grid. It'll either be capable or not capable of handling that load. And you go through a rather extensive process, from what I understand, with utility engineering folks. You do want to bring your own expertise to the table when you go through this process. It can be prolonged, and if I am not mistaken, it hasn't been absolutely with 100% clarity ruled on yet by the PUC on exactly what those timelines for, let's say, resolution of construction requirements or quality of your interconnection that you have. But it's an integral piece, but you're correct in asking the question, I believe. There's multiple pieces. You have your price piece, you have your facility construction piece, and you have your interconnection piece. And they're all equally important.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much, Steve. We appreciate it. And actually, since we're running short on time, we had Ida Tech to tell us about fuel cells. What I think I'm going to do is close the informational hearing and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2625. And first, I'm going to have Mike Graney come up and talk a little bit about that bill. So I just wanted to make sure that we had an adequate time for a hearing on that. And so with that, I'm going to close the informational part of this committee meeting, informational session on renewable energy, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2625. And Kat, why don't you go ahead and just read us the overview, and then we're going to invite Mike Graney up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2625 authorizes issuance of lottery bonds for grants to agencies in the Executive Department and certain private companies to acquire fuel cell systems. It appropriates money from the Backup Power Fuel Cell Pilot Program account to the State Department of Energy to provide grants to assist in acquisition of fuel cell systems. The bill sunsets January 2nd, 2010, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. And I want to call Mike Rainey up, and then if you want to make an introductory comment. And I want to thank Mike for coming over here today. Mike Rainey is with the Department of Energy and has worked very closely with this committee on House Bill 2210, 2211, and 2212. So we appreciate you being here. Before you get started, I just wanted to see if, since Representative Burley and Senator Westland are also co-carriers of this bill, if either of you wanted to mention anything before we get started.
Well, Madam
good
Chair,
bill should pass.
The bill should pass, and I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, for also signing on as a sponsor of this bill. And I think what I'll do is just defer to Tucker Roberti to explain the details and Director Graney, so we'll just, in the best interest of time, move forward.
Thank you. And thanks, Mike, for making the track. I'm sure you're also very happy to be out of Capitol.
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Graney for Department of Energy. It's always a pleasure to come over here to Bend. Let me just mention that I think the testimony you've heard so far just underscores the importance of the bills you've already passed in the House and the renewable portfolio standard bill in the Senate that I'm confident with some additional work we'll get a good bill out of there and over to the House. It's very exciting, and I appreciate very much all the strong support we've had from both houses for the legislative package. I think we can really do some great things here in Oregon, and the people you've heard from this morning or this afternoon have demonstrated that. Let me just mention that fuel cells are an important technology. They can use gas produced from renewable energy, and regardless of the source of the fuel for fuel cells. They're extremely efficient, so there's great benefits there in terms of just energy efficiency as well, in terms of whatever application they have. The bill before you kind of focuses on small fuel cells that would be used for backup systems. It's very promising, providing a number of these at one time, which the bill does, helps as one more tool to help the technology develop, show demonstrations and applicability. There's other fuel cells as well. There's larger scale fuel cells, for example, to provide power for a small building full time. But this, the scope of the funding here would accomplish what the bill lays out. I should mention that since it's not in the governor's budget, technically I can't take a position in terms of the funding level, but that's up to you. I'd be happy to answer any questions or defer to your other witnesses here.
Thank you. Any questions right now for Mr. Viney? Okay, thank you. And if you can stick around, because there might be some other questions.
So, Mike, if by miraculous chance it ends up in the co-chair's budget, I assume the executive branch will not be in opposition.
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, I don't foresee any reason why we would be.
No.
I think we could certainly implement this administratively from both a technical and administrative point of view.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay. All right, and now I'd like to call up IDATEC, and we have Tucker Roberti. And I also want to mention we do have a sign-up sheet, and I don't know if folks knew. If anybody here would like to testify on this bill, we have a sign-up sheet right here if you wanted to come up and sign up, and I'll call up other witnesses.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and the rest of the committee, and Senator Westland, thanks very much for coming over today and having this hearing. I'd actually like to start with a question. Are you interested in a short version?
Yeah, we have 15 minutes, and I want to make sure there's time for questions. Is there anybody else here that would like to testify in this bill today? Okay, so you have 15 minutes, and then we'll shut down this hearing, but I want to make sure that we have time for questions as well.
Ian or anyone, do you know how to get from this stick onto a presentation?
Maybe you could help out with that, so he can just start going with his presentation.
Is it the right room? Okay, there we go. Okay, I'd like to start out by saying that, talk a little bit about the previous testimony before I talk about this House bill. I don't think I can add to framing the issue. I think Sylvia and Greg did a great job, but I would like to add that House bills 22, 10, 11, and 12, Retsy and Betsy, I think help continue to make Oregon a leader in energy policy, and they're an incredible tool to attract energy technology companies into the state of Oregon and create important and clean and high-tech jobs for the future. I also believe that the renewable portfolio standard, there's been a lot of work put into it, could also continue to help Oregon be a leader in energy and job creation, and that the Renewable Energy Working Group, I know, has put in a lot of effort, and hopefully that effort is beneficial to the House and Senate and their deliberations. And I guess, you know, I had a presentation, and my goal was to help answer the question of how fuel cells fit in with renewable energy, and so maybe if there's time, I'll flip back to that, but for the sake of time, I will jump straight into my specific testimony on House Bill 2625 and the subject at hand. Mr. Graney hit the highlights already, but the bill would support the deployment of 35 to 50 backup power fuel cell systems in the state of Oregon. It would fund at 100% level any public safety applications, and the goal would be to fund at least 50% of these public safety applications to improve the reliability of public safety communication systems, fire, police, state police, emergency preparedness systems like that. And then we also fund 50% of private sector programs to deploy these fuel cell systems. The expected results would include job growth, the displacement of dirty technologies. Fuel cells are significantly cleaner distributed energy generation technologies versus traditional generators, 99% cleaner in terms of nitrous oxides and sulfur oxides, and 35 to about 75% cleaner in carbon monoxide emissions. And then also reduce CO2 because of the increased efficiency. Total program cost is proposed at $985,000. I believe this bill would be leveraging earlier support of the fuel cell industry in Oregon. Oregon companies have benefited from multiple Department of Energy programs that are multi-millions of dollars, approaching $10 million. Multiple Department of Defense programs have been invested into the state of Oregon fuel cell industry, approximately, again, $10 million. And there's actually been a lot of European government money that has flowed into the state of Oregon to support our fuel cell industry, because our technology is just above and beyond what they had available in Europe, and they were importing this technology and spending money in Oregon, which is like a really great thing. And then years of substantial and sustained investment from our early owners. Over the past 10 years, there's been a lot of money spent to get the fuel cell industry to the point where we're ready to offer commercially available product. We're at the doorstep to enter a new phase here. Recent successes that the company has had, we've been selected as a preferred provider of fuel cell systems for a 15-state consortium called the Western State Contracting Alliance, of which Oregon is a member. We're also the first fuel cell system to be certified to the brand new fuel cell standard, which defines safety and performance, which again opens the path to commercial deployment. And just very recently received some additional DoD contracts.
Tucker, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure.
What criteria do you need to meet in order to become a preferred vendor for the Western States Contracting Alliance?
It was a multifaceted solicitation. It was a mix of price and performance primarily, mm-hmm. and on each side of that there were several selection criteria. So it was meant to select overall value for the participating states. And this was particularly focused on backup power fuel cell systems. And the reason, as you'll see, I think it's in this presentation, although it may have been in the previous one that we skipped, is that backup power fuel cells are really the next step in making fuel cell systems commercially available. And so WSCA selected backup power is the tool to open up the industry.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So as a result of earlier support, I believe IDATAC and the industry in general is uniquely positioned right now to transition into commercial sales. And support this year, again, is going to leverage substantial earlier investment and accelerate job growth and market development. And this is not a stationary target. Our competitors are worldwide. And this is a make-or-break year for the fuel cell industry, or the players in the fuel cell industry. A lot of companies are on the brink of either making it or not going forward. We're luckily not in that position, but there's about 15 worldwide competitors. We're in the top three right now, and this is our chance to really break through. And this bill is an opportunity to help prove in Oregon that these fuel cell systems make sense. Part of this program is to evaluate how well these fuel cells work, the economic benefits, and the results, and that proof is really going to be part of proving that you know, Oregon-made products are ready to be deployed around the world. And we do have a worldwide presence, as you know, many of you have visited earlier this morning. Noted, we're in, I think, 15 countries now and have distributorships, much more commercial activity actually outside of the U.S. than in the U.S. right now. Just a visual representation of where the market is right now. There's the early adopters at the very high prices have come in already. Limited numbers of commercial sales are taking place at that level. We're now ready to offer products at the backup and standby level, which is $3,000 a kilowatt. The next place on this cost curve, which is probably a couple years further out, is the remote, stationary, and portable markets. These are things like lighthouses, remote communication sites, cabins in the woods, things like that, as well as portable electronics. And then the next step after that is really stationary mass markets. These are fuel cells for homes. And then, you know, a little bit further out is automotive. You look at the cost for automotive, it's $50 per kilowatt of fuel cell power capacity versus where we're starting to go commercial now is $3,000 per kilowatt. So you can see that it's going to take time to reach automotive, but there's lots of jobs and economic activity to take place leading up to that. This is kind of a one slide to summarize what we at IDATEC view as the fuel cell industry in Oregon and what a thriving industry would look like here. Fuel cells require hydrogen to produce their electricity. The source of that hydrogen can be from natural gas, it can be from diesel, but it also can be from ethanol, biomethanol, biodiesel, and we believe right here in Oregon there's the forest biomass, there's the agricultural inputs to make renewable fuels, and IDATEC on the left has the technologies to convert those fuels into renewable hydrogen to make high reliability, low emissions power generation technology here in the state. We also, you know, we have about 63 people at IDATEC right now, and it's the proportion of PhDs and engineers is way over 50% of our employment. We're high-paying, high-education jobs, and these markets for our products are absolutely worldwide. So that is the end of my comments on 2625, and
thank you. Thank you so much, Chuck. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Burley.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Tucker, in the bill, on page 1, line 7, it says that one of the qualifications here is that the fuel cell systems have to be certified by the Western States Contracting Alliance. What's the value to the state of Oregon if we're going to make this investment, what's the value to the state to require this certification by Western States Contracting Alliance?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That process took place over about 2 years to develop the qualification criteria, and it is it's the first process of its kind to really methodically interview end users and fuel cell manufacturers to figure out how government buyers can get the best value for their fuel cell spending dollar. And so this is a competitive solicitation to select the most cost-effective and, and the safest and most reliable fuel cell system. So basically there's been a lot of upfront work to down select to which fuel cell systems actually offer a good value, are safe, reliable. And so this process, instead of shooting in the dark trying to figure out, well, how do you select a good fuel cell system, this is leveraging that good work that WSCA has already accomplished.
Follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Just so to make sure I understand, maybe I'll paraphrase this and sort of put it in the form of a question. So would it be accurate to say then that a product that is certified or a producer that's certified under this alliance would actually save the state of Oregon some considerable time and resources in having to make that qualification itself, because this producer already comes with that?
That's exactly correct, and that's why the states actually asked for that process. They didn't feel they had the resources on their own to go out and select fuel cell systems.
Okay. And one other question, mm-hmm. Madam Chair. Thank you. There are, if I'm not mistaken, different types of fuel cell systems. For example, the power backup versus continuous primary power or combined heat and power applications.
That's correct.
Would this Western States Contracting Alliance certify all of those types? Do they have different categories for each of those types? How does that work?
So at the beginning of the WSCA process, they went out and looked at a wide range of potential applications, everything from large stationary combined heat and power systems down to portable fuel cell systems. And the only market where they felt there was sufficient competition in commercially available products was this backup power market. They made a statement that they would like to, in the future, have additional solicitations for residential combined heat and power, commercial combined heat and power, portable fuel cell systems. But right now, there was just not sufficient competition and product availability to go after those. So it's a future goal for WSCA. And by the way, WSCA has 13 contracts. This fuel cell contract is its 14th contract, most of them for copiers, office supplies, things of that nature, and paper products. And so this is their first energy-related effort, and I think they're very pleased with the results so far.
One last question, mm-hmm. Thank you. So the continuous primary power fuel cells and the combined heat and power application fuel cells right now cannot be certified under Western States Contracting Alliance, is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Byer.
Thank you. Further question about this WSCA, or whatever we're calling this. Is this a one-time thing? Because as we're hearing, this is an industry that's growing, and it seems to me like this should be a process that as companies start growing and getting more competitive, they should be able to start competing in this. So is this something that will continue to happen?
That's a great question. And prices are fixed for 1 year, and the contract is fixed for 2 years. And at that point, they would reassess the available products and markets and hopefully expand the WSCA process. And what they also did is they realized that fuel cells are not very standardized yet. Some have features and functions that are better in some applications than other applications. So they divided the backup power market into two categories, a 1 to 5 kilowatt category, and then a 5 to 20 kilowatt category, and then selected three fuel cell system providers in each of those categories in order to make it inclusive, like you said, and recognize that there's differences right now in systems. And then going forward, I think it was a good choice to redo this in total in 2 years. The process took 2 years, so they didn't want to do it right away next year, but I think 2 years is a reasonable approach.
Thanks for that clarification, Chuck. Are there any other questions, Senator?
Well, maybe just a comment, and it's partially along the lines of Representative Burley's question, but also really for today's whole hearing. And that is, this WSCA contract is a huge deal, certainly for IDATEC, but also for Oregon, because it continues, you know, to extol what is our brand, Oregon's brand, is a clean, environmentally friendly state. And we trade on that with Pacific Rim companies. Certainly we're a little bit behind the curve on some of the RPS, but that's soon to be rectified. All of these efforts combined are equally important. They're variables in the equation, not just for jobs and the environment, but also international trade. This attracts additional businesses and industries here because they want to live in that type of environment. So as all of these separate pieces come together in kind of the jigsaw puzzle to continue to present Oregon as, you know, a leader in these industries, it helps improve our brand. And I cannot, and this goes right back to the WSCA contract, I cannot stress how important that is, certainly for IDATEC, but for Oregon as a whole. So congratulations on that. And
thank you.
We stand ready to help you in any way we can.
Thank you very much, Senator. And I would like to add that the awardees on this WSCA contract were from Toronto, Washington State, California, and Oregon. There were no European competitors, but there's a whole slew of them out there that we see in the market every day. And then also, the state of Oregon's Department of Administrative Services was a co-founder of the group to develop this particular WSCA contract and participated in it to make sure that the results were beneficial for the state of Oregon.
Well, any other questions before we close the public hearing, or anybody else from the audience that would like to testify? Okay, we have one gentleman who'd like to come up, and please state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Les Lambert from Bend. First, to answer your question about the solar water heating and how to encourage it, and this ties in with Senate Bill 373, the RPS, Renewable Portfolio Standard. I don't know how much you envision encouraging conservation, just plain energy efficiency, as part of the RPS. So far I've heard solar biomass, wind, geothermal, and so on. But I think energy efficiency should and could be a component of this. And the encouragement of solar energy, direct water heating in homes, for example. Encouraging conservation, just plain energy efficiency as part of the RPS. So far I've heard solar biomass, wind, geothermal, and so on. But I think energy efficiency should and could be a component of this. And the encouragement of solar energy, direct water heating in homes, for example, could be offered to utilities as one pathway to achieving that 8%, a part of the 25% goal. And I think that that concept could be expanded to connect with several other underserved markets. For example, in speaking with the Department of Energy, they are finding that encouraging efficiency in commercial and institutional buildings is not something that they want to do in the way of operating and maintenance efficiency, for example, through the Betsy. I submitted an amendment that so far hasn't gotten anywhere to encourage that through Betsy. So an alternative path to accomplish that, which I think is an untapped resource, if you think that if you get the right people involved in facilities and can save 10% of the budget that they presently spend on energy just by operating and maintaining things more efficiently with little capital, that's a worthwhile target. And so including efficiency in the RPS for the utilities can, by having staff or referring people to ways that those things can happen, that would be a valid way of meeting part of the 25% target.
Thank you for that suggestion. Do you want to comment on this bill at all?
No, I already submitted some stuff that had to do with 2211, and I want to talk to Senator Westland later about that because he has an opportunity to amend it. I think there is one thing that's being missed. Current Betsy is 35% for conservation of buildings, and it's being proposed to increase it to 50% for alternative energy, wind, solar, and so on. The thing that I think could be improved in Betsy is that 35% is presently the level of incentive that's offered for either improvements in efficiency in new construction or efficiency improvements in buildings through retrofits. So that puts us in the position of offering the same incentive level to avoid mistakes as it is as we are offering to fix mistakes. And historically, the building codes have been a moving target, which always characterizes build it cheap and have an opportunity for retrofit later. And so by improving the Betsy incentive levels to 50% for new construction, we could avoid some of those retrofit opportunities. And historically, we have looked at a carrot approach more than a stick approach. The building code, stiffening the building codes has raised the hackles in some quarters, and the incentives are a more palatable approach to accomplish the same thing. And I think that you could do that by raising the Betsy level of incentive to 50% for conservation of buildings as well as for alternative energy. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate you coming up. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2625 and close the meeting of the House Energy Environment Committee. And again, I want to thank the City of Portland for hosting us here today. We really
Excuse me.
Oh, I didn't know you wanted to say something.
No, the best city, the city of what?
Did I?
You said Portland.
Yeah, I'm sorry. City of Bend. Freudian slip. I'm thinking my own district. I had to get my own district in there. You guys said Bend so many times today. I want to thank the City of Bend for hosting us today. And I was thinking that maybe next time I'll have a hearing in my own city, in the City of Portland. So appreciate it. And I was going to say that I'm hoping we'll be able to come back another time, maybe during the interim, for a tour of some of the facilities that we couldn't see today. So thank you so much.
It's a single syllable word, Jackie.